Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Thelonious Monk with Sonny Rollins, Ernie Henry, and Clark Terry, Brilliant Corners.
Oh. I do believe this is a jazz album, I would imagine.
So this is what it says on allmusic.com. It says, although Brilliant Corners is Thelonious Monk's third disc for Riverside, it's the first on the label to weigh in with such heavy original material. Enthusiasts who become jaded to the idiosyncratic nature of Monk's playing for his practically arithmetical chord progressions should occasionally revisit Brilliant Corners. There is an inescapable freshness and vitality saturated into every measure of every song. The passage of time makes it all the more difficult to imagine any other musicians bearing the capacity to support Monk with such ironic precision. The assembled quartet for the lion's share of the session includes Max Roach on percussion, Sonny Rollins on tenor sax, Oscar Pettiford on bass, and Ernie Henry on alto sax. Although a compromise, the selection of Miles Davis's bassist, Paul Chambers, and Clark Henry on trumpet on Bemshaw Swing reveals what might be considered an accident of ecstasy, as they provide a timeless balance between support and being able to further the cause musically. Likewise, Roach's timpani interjections supply an off-balance sonic surrealism while progressing the rhythm in and out of the holes provided by Monk's jackrabbit leads. It's easy to write Monk's ferocity and Forrest Gump-esque ingenuity off as gimmick or quirkiness. What cannot be dismissed is Monk's ability to translate emotions into the language of music, as in the freedom and abandon he allows through Sonny Rollins and Max Roach's mesmerizing solos in Brilliant Corners. The childlike innocence evoked by Monk's incorporation of the celeste during the achingly beautiful ode Panonica raises the emotional bar several degrees. Perhaps more pointed, however, is the impassioned I Surrender Dear, the only solo performance on the album. Brilliant Corners may well be considered the alpha and omega of post-World War II American jazz. No serious jazz collection should be without it.
Okay.
So, the album was released on April 4th, 1957, and the genre is hard bop, which is a subgenre of jazz, released on Riverside Records and produced by Oren Keepnews. And there are only five songs on the album. The first side they're quite long. So the first side has two songs, Brilliant Corners and Balu Bolivar Balu Ar. I think that's Spanish. And then side two has three songs. So if you're listening along, that's what we're going to do. Here is the... Have you heard this album?
I think I've heard bits and pieces of it.
Yeah.
Like Bemsha Swing and stuff like that. I've heard the title. I'm sure I've heard the piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember it.
Yeah. So here we go. Here is the first song called, which is also the title track, Brilliant Corner. Here we go. OK, Okay, and ending side one with Blue Bolivar Blues R. I'm really enjoying this so far. I'm not that familiar with jazz. This is totally outside of my wheelhouse, really. But I'm really enjoying this. It's very laid back. It's very relaxing, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's almost too relaxing. It's almost like I'm having a hard time trying to stay concentrating. But I'm enjoying it. It's definitely really good music. And again, I think we touched on this last time we had a jazz album from this period. But the production quality is just top notch. I mean, it sounds like it was recorded yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No. And one of the things that I did notice, and it's something that I don't think you could quite get away with in rock music, is that bass solo. And it went on longer than I was I liked it, but it went on longer than I was expecting. And if a solo, bass or otherwise, and it was clearly improvised, and the guy, I don't know the bass player's name, but he was clearly making it up as he was going along. I mean, that's a lot of what jazz is, but he was obviously making it up, and which is cool, but I could hear it. And it's sort of like if a guitar player in a rock band had done the same thing, people would have cast it as self-indulgent and ridiculous and stupid, and all, look at the ego on that guitar player. So it's interesting that in jazz you can kind of get away with that kind of thing, but you can't really do that in rock music.
It's partly sort of the expectation, but I don't know, you go back to the 60s and 70s, and especially in the 60s, like think of Jack Bruce and Cream and some of their like long improvised solos and the live stuff. They've got more live tracks than the recorded tracks on anything they put out at the period anyway. And I mean, both Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker were very definitely jazz background.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Cream was really a jazz band.
Yeah. Blues based rock band. Yes. It's interesting. You can sort of hear that sort of the influences from stuff like this and other jazz albums from the time, and they definitely did that in a rock setting and a pop setting. But I guess you could sort of get away with that when there was more of an expectation. I think people sort of, especially after, progressive rock sort of became a little bit too bloated in the later 70s, and that's when punk really hit, because punk was like the antithesis to that. It's like, we need like rock and roll to go back to its rock and roll roots. And it was ever since that happened, people would look at soloing in rock and roll as almost like self-indulgent and stuff like that. Because before that, you could get away with a lot without being like, being overtly, called self-indulgent. In fact, most people were, there was always a line. You cross a certain line and everybody would get bored, but you could get away with a whole lot more. And
yeah, it's just funny though that like the expectations are different, I guess. You know, the expectations in jazz. And the other thing is, like on the first track, Brilliant Corners, and I've noticed this with a lot of jazz, is they're playing notes that are outside of the key, but it's, I don't know how to describe it. I don't know a lot about music theory,
it's discordant.
Yeah.
Is what it's called. But it's intentional. I've heard many a jazz player say that. I think Miles Davis has said it, and I think a lot of other jazz musicians have said it. It's just like, if you're going to make a wrong, I think even Frank Zappa said it. If you're going to make a wrong note, if you play it again, it's cool.
Yeah. I think I know what you're saying. I think the quote is, one wrong note is a mistake. Two wrong notes is jazz, or something like that. Yeah, no, I mean, and the other thing too, like I'm just sort of comparing it against what I know, and like the drums, I guess in jazz, you don't really play a much of a backbeat. You just sort of you're using the snare as more of an accent, and it's mostly on the cymbals that you're keeping time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, sometimes there's a bit of a kick, but the kick drum isn't as pronounced as it is in later music. And that came along with like a rock and roll thing. It's people really wanted that. Well, it was a dance music sort of thing. When rock and roll hit in the 50s, they really wanted something that made the people get up and dance, and you need that kick drum and the bass line to be prominent. In jazz, it was just not that important.
Yeah, I guess you dance to jazz, but you...
You boogie to jazz.
You boogie to jazz. Yeah, you don't need that driving beat.
Not the same way.
Not the same way, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's cool. You can hear that all the musicians are playing live in the same room, and it's they're playing off of each other. That like that bass player is like once that bass player is done with his solo, the drummer did a solo, and so I don't know how many takes they would have done, but obviously no two takes would have been the same.
Basically. This is like mostly live off the floor. This is not piecemeal.
Yeah, no, and that's really cool. And whenever if they would perform it live, each performance would not be the same. And I guess there's the composition is like the basic riff.
It kind of holds the song together. It's what makes it sort of familiar. But the soloing and anything in between is going to be, well, radically different. And that's where interest, like other performances, if they're recorded anywhere, become sort of interesting. It's like, oh, I really like the one where they did it, like, you know, such and such jazz club back in 1959.
Yeah. And bringing it back to the rock world, that's sort of how like the Grateful Dead operated, and people like and Cream and people like that.
Thinking of like the James Gang. I've got a couple of live, at least one in particular, one live James Gang album things that they do. It's live at Carnegie Hall, and I'm thinking of some versions of that where they're a little bit more extended and stuff like that, and I really like what they're doing with the tracks and stuff like that. So that's just one example that just popped into my head. So
it's really cool that this stuff is out there. And one of the cool things I did notice about this, or I did read about this album, is if I can find it again, is on it was in 2003. It was one of 50 recordings chosen that year by the Library of Congress to be added to the National Recording Registry. This is, as far as like shaping American music, this is one of the albums that contributed to that. Like, this is a very important album in terms of it's like shaping American culture. And you can argue whether the U.S. has a culture, but like, and this is an important album in shaping that. So this is like, I don't know, this is like the white album of jazz or something like that. That's actually, no, probably there's probably, I think that's probably
maybe
Miles
Abbey
Davis
Road.
kind of blue. Yeah, maybe Abbey Road. Anyway, I guess we'll get back to it. The second side of the album, it starts off with the song Panonica. So here we go.
Or Panonica.
Panonica. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Okay, and ending the album with Bemshaw Swing. Ending the last song was a little more upbeat.
Yeah. I think that was I don't know if they released necessarily like a single from the album, but that would have been the single from the album, even though it clocks in at 7:43.
Yeah, I think Big Sugar did this on their first album.
First album, yes. Yes, they did. I was going to say so, yep.
I really like this album a lot, actually. I always whenever I hear jazz, I think, oh yeah, I want to get into jazz, and I never do. But when I hear it, I like it. But it's never something that I actively listen to. I always intend to, but I never actually, you know, pick up a jazz album or anything like that.
It's funny because it's just like, I don't know, maybe it's just something about her personality or something. Like, we're never really, you know, actively in the mood for it until, or at least we don't really think about being in the mood for it or something like that. But honestly, it's always pleasant. So, and it's, I mean, without jazz, without the blues, there'd be no rock and roll. I mean, vast whopping majority of the music we listen to wouldn't exist without stuff like this. So
exactly. Exactly. No, this is the foundation of all of rock and roll is blues, jazz, and country. And, you know, it's those three elements that created rock and roll. This album is cool. I like the improvisational element to it. That's really probably my favorite part of it. I like that it was obviously recorded live and there's no overdubs from what I can tell. And although there wasn't a lot of overdubs in the 50s,
most things were recorded pretty straightforward. I mean, if they did something at all, it was very rare. Just the way the tracking system was set up was very difficult to go and do stuff. It took the Beatles basically to go, hey, we want that 8-track machine in here. And then they start taking lines of tape and stringing them across the room and cutting them into pieces and stuff like that and doing all this other weird stuff that allowed the technology to sort of evolve into being able to actually track by track record.
And it was Les Paul that invented that.
Yes, Les Paul actually invented most of the multi-track recording and stuff like that.
I always think about this is if they had that technology at the time, would they have used it? Like, would this, is this a limitation of the technology or like just working within what they have? Or like if they had that technology, would they still choose to record this way? And there's no way to really know.
Yeah, there's no way to really know. It just seems to be, you know, is it a limitation of the recording or was it a limitation that the band imposed or something like that? It's sort of tricky to say what would have come out of things if multi-track recording was adopted. Like Les Paul invented the stuff back in the, I think it was the early 50s and only expanded upon it throughout the 50s. But again, it didn't take until the Beatles in their EMI studio and stuff like that and exploring until it was like really became used in a pop music setting. Not that, you know, Les Paul and Mary Ford weren't like somewhat pop music, but it was still very experimental at the time.
It's cool that like, even though they don't have the multi-track technology or they're not really using it, is like you were saying before, how well recorded this is, like how, and I don't like you can hear every instrument clearly, like there's no, it's not muddy. Like a lot of the time, a lot of the problems with recording live is a lack of separation and the ability to mix well. And I don't know a lot about how recording techniques in the 50s, but I know if you want to record live, what you kind of have to do is you have to put up baffles in between the instruments so you can have a little bit of separation so you can mix it well. I don't know if they had those. They must have had something like that in this era.
Well, they start off with a room that's got really good sound. Most recording studios had such a thing. So there's not a lot of extra bouncing around unless you're, again, Les Paul and you intentionally record in the bathroom to get a natural reverb. But stuff like that. If you're going to record straight off the floor, like they use baffles, they use acoustic paneling, anything like that to get as clean a sound as possible. But any like anomalies within, like, you know, mistakes or coughing or some guy smoking in the back or something like that, you hear little things and you can't necessarily remove them. At least you couldn't at the time. So it just becomes part of the experience. And I think that's lacking in a lot of modern recording.
Yeah, you sort of keep the mistakes. Yeah, you keep the the imperfections. And obviously if they're improvising, you know, if it's a really bad mistake, I'm sure they would say, hey, no, stop, and we'll do another take. But like, other than that, I mean, if they're a little bit sharp or flat or something, I mean, they're not gonna try to fix. They can't try to fix it. So yeah. So like, I don't know a whole lot about jazz to really talk about this in an informed way in a lot of detail. But I really like this, and I guess the inevitable question is, would you listen to this again?
Oh yeah, I'd listen to this
again. Yeah, I would too.
What was the other one we were listening to? The
Dave Brubeck.
Dave Brubeck. That's the other one. Yeah, I'd like to see more jazz albums appear in this list. So
yeah, so like I that's right, because I want to, like, it's very relaxing music. It's good to, like, if you're I don't want people to take this the wrong way, but it is good background music. If you're doing something like working or like doing the dishes or chores or whatever, or like working on a project or something, it's good music to put on for that. And I don't mean that that's all it is. It's like, you can obviously sit down and listen to it and enjoy it as the main entertainment, but it's really also good to put on while you're doing something else, because it's all instrumental. There's no words to sort of...
Well, this album and this the album. Brubeck album and many other ones are, but like that as well.
Instrumental jazz is good.
Instrumental jazz is good for that. But yeah. even things like Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday and stuff like that, it can be pretty good for that too, especially if you're familiar with it. First few times you listen to it, you kind of want to pay attention to it. But it's really good stuff to, I don't know, just put you in a better mood. It's just, or a different mood anyway. But yeah, it can be sort of melancholy, but that's not a bad thing.
That's not a bad thing, no. I love this, and I want to listen to more jazz. And so I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, we want to hear from you, whether you agree or disagree with our review of the album. You can always reach out to us by going to the contact page of the website, polyphonicpress.com. And while you're there, you can check out previous episodes. If you'd like to support the show, you can do that by going to buymeacoffee.com/polyphonicpress. It's really easy. You don't need to sign up for anything. All those links are in the show notes. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.